Welcome back to The Mystical Positivist. I am your host, Stuart Goodnick. During the second hour of our program, Rob Schmidt and I will be switching gears and discussing the latest blog from neuroscientist, philosopher, and author Sam Harris. His October 12th essay entitled, This Must Be Heaven, is a response to a recent Newsweek cover story by the same title detailing the out-of-body experience by neurosurgeon Eben Alexander after he fell into a coma having contracted a bad case of bacterial meningitis. Given that our guest last week was speaking on the subject of out-of-body experiences and that we'll be picking up this conversation again next week with our upcoming guest, Kevin Turner, we thought this would make a fitting interlude. So we're going to start, I think, with Rob's going to just kind of locate us with this piece by reading the first few paragraphs of Sam Harris's essay, and then we'll get into more discussion. I should mention that we're now, we don't have anyone on the phone, so if anyone is interested in calling in and contributing to the conversation, you can call us in the studio at area code 707-874-1073. That's area code 707-874-1073. So, Rob, take it away.
Okay, so I'll just locate this by its web address by just pointing out that this is Sam Harris's blog at www.samharris.org/blog/item/this-must-be-heaven,
Yeah,
each of the words.
Just go to samharris.org and
yeah,
you'll see the link for it.
And you'll find it. So here's the piece. He starts off. Once upon a time, a neurosurgeon named Eben Alexander contracted a bad case of bacterial meningitis and fell into a coma. While immobile in his hospital bed, he experienced visions of such intense beauty that they changed everything. Not just for him, but for all of us and for science as a whole. According to Newsweek, Alexander's experience proves that proves that consciousness is independent of the brain, that death is an illusion, and that an eternity of perfect splendor awaits us beyond the grave, complete with the usual angels, clouds, and departed relatives, but also butterflies and beautiful girls in peasant dress. Our current understanding of the mind, quote, now lies broken at our feet, unquote. For as the doctor writes, quote, what happened to me destroyed it, and I intend to spend the rest of my life investigating the true nature of consciousness and making the fact that we are more, much more, than our physical brains as clear as I can, both to my fellow scientists and to people at large, unquote. Well, Harris goes on to say, I intend to spend the rest of the morning sparing him the effort. Whether you read it online or hold the physical object in your hands, this issue of Newsweek is best viewed as an archaeological artifact that is certain to embarrass us in the eyes of future generations. Its existence surely says more about our time than the editors at the magazine meant to say. For the cover alone reveals the abasement and desperation of our journalism, the intellectual bankruptcy and resultant tenacity of faith-based religion, and our ubiquitous confusion about the nature of scientific authority. And I should point out that the picture of this cover has a hand reaching up towards a sky filled with clouds, the sun breaking through in a particular way, and the headline reads, Heaven is Real, and then the subhead is A Doctor's Experience of the Afterlife. So that's what he's responding to there. Harris goes on to say, the article is the modern equivalent of a 14th century woodcut depicting the work of alchemists, inquisitors, crusaders, and fortune tellers. I hope our descendants understand that at least some of us were blushing. As many of you know, Harris goes on to write, I am interested in, quote, spiritual, unquote, experiences of the sort Alexander reports. Unlike many atheists, I don't doubt the subjective phenomena themselves. That is, I don't believe that everyone who claims to have seen an angel or left his body in a trance or become one with the universe is lying or mentally ill. Indeed, I have had similar experiences myself in meditation, in lucid dreams, even while meditating in a lucid dream, and through the use of various psychedelics in times gone by. I know that astonishing changes in the contents of consciousness are possible and can be psychologically transformative. And unlike many neuroscientists and philosophers, Harris goes on to say, I remain agnostic on the question of how consciousness is related to the physical world. There are, of course, very good reasons to believe that it is an emergent property of brain activity, just as the rest of the human mind obviously is. But we know nothing about how such a miracle of emergence might occur. And if consciousness were, in fact, irreducible, or even separable from the brain in a way that would give comfort to St. Augustine, my worldview would not be overturned. I know that we do not understand consciousness, and nothing that I think I know about the cosmos or about the patent falsity of most religious beliefs requires that I deny this. So, although, Harris writes, although I am an atheist who can be expected to be unforgiving of religious dogma, I am not reflexively hostile to claims of the sort Alexander has made. In principle, my mind is open. And he puts in parentheses, it really is. And the final paragraph I'm going to read here is, he continues, but Alexander's account is so bad, his reasoning so lazy and tendentious, that it would be beneath notice if it were not for the fact that it currently disgraces the cover of a major news magazine. Alexander is also releasing a book at the end of the month called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, which seems destined to become an instant bestseller. As much as I would like to simply ignore the unfolding travesty, it would be derelict of me to do so. And so the conclusion of, or the rest of the article, is basically a dissection of the reasons not to accept the claims that the neurosurgeon makes in the piece in Newsweek,
but presumably also
in the book.
Right, and he encourages the reader to be sure to read the article first.
He provides a link immediately after this part that I've just read for us here.
So there's a lot of interesting material here. One is that one of the reasons I actually like Sam Harris a lot is that I'm very sympathetic to the kind of sensibility that he's describing in this piece, in the sense that he doesn't stake out conclusions the way many militant atheists do.
Right.
I hesitate to apply the label atheist to him because he doesn't bring a fundamentalism to this aspect of things. He has a kind of a fundamentalism in some aspects of his writing, particularly when he gets into terrorism.
Terrorism and Islam in particular, yeah.
But when he talks about, like, consciousness, he's willing, you know, he, as a neuroscientist as well as a philosopher, favors the idea that consciousness is in some way an emergent property of the brain, but he acknowledges the possibility that consciousness is irreducible, which is a fundamental philosophical question on consciousness, which essentially means that in the end, consciousness is not caused by something else. It can't be explained by physiological properties. It simply is, and it is as fundamental a nature, an aspect of reality as, say, matter or energy is. So that would be irreducibility. And he even goes on to say that if we found consciousness was separable from the physical organism as in a way that would please St. Augustine, that his worldview wouldn't change. And that's what I find interesting, is his worldview wouldn't change because his worldview is about not allowing your conclusions to get ahead of the facts that you can actually assert or put together in terms of direct experience. And this is where it gets kind of into an interesting gray area. You know, for instance, his critique of the neurosurgeon is that, you know, first of all, the neurosurgeon is making claims about neurology that go beyond probably his skill set or training as a neurosurgeon.
Right, which is probably fair. In other words, because he knows how to cut up a brain, does that make him necessarily a scientist,
right?
Or does it make him a spokesman for science and what science can or should do or believe,
right?
Or assert?
And so I think the area that, you know, which is a little bit of quibbling on Harris's part, but the area where he first stakes out is that Alexander makes a claim about his brain being off or him being brain dead at some point during this meningitis ordeal, and so he takes as significant or he takes as this as a piece of evidence of provability that he was having an experience of consciousness
and afterlife experience
when the brain was not functioning. And right. Harris takes issue with that, which I think is appropriate, that is by no means conclusive at all. And that's probably the...
In fact, it's even poor reasoning in a lot of ways. I've certainly seen in a novel the assertion that in fact just because the electrical activity is not discernible to the instruments we have now doesn't mean that synaptic activity has entirely ceased.
Right. And so Alexander had a very powerful subjective experience, which Harris is not denying, and Harris isn't even being facile to say that, oh, this guy's deluding himself or something like that. He's simply saying that from that experience, you can't jump to a necessary conclusion that heaven, quote unquote, exists.
Right.
Now,
or that consciousness necessarily extends, that this guy's experience doesn't prove that consciousness extends beyond the lifespan of the organism.
Right. And I think that his quibble then with Alexander is that he has a fundamental misunderstanding of science properly conducted, that it's one thing for him to make claims about his experience and to have a personal interpretation, but to offer this as proof establishes a higher bar. And I think that's probably where Harris, in his inimitable, arch, sarcastic way, actually is going with this piece. And the reason it raises an interesting question is that we touched on this last week, but our guest last week was a guy named Luis Manero, who's a...
our guest in the store.
Right.
And on the radio.
On the radio. And he had just recently published a book called Demystifying Out-of-Body Experiences, and he works as an instructor for the International Academy of Consciousness. And he lays forth in his book a fairly complete metaphysics, as it were, about out-of-body experiences and the nature of extra-physical consciousness and experience. And his point in the book is that one should not believe any of this stuff a priori, but that one can, through consistent application of some basic practices, ultimately cultivate the ability to have an out-of-body experience and begin to establish this, what he's saying, through one's own direct experience. But it still raises the question of how can you really know whether or not it's all in the brain or not?
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that Harris's point, which he in this particular blog piece that we're referring to here, he's pretty nuanced in his critique, in the sense that he's raising the issues of these issues of epistemology. How can you actually know the answer to the question of what is consciousness and what is the relationship of consciousness to physical manifestations, and even what does it mean to say, I think it's fair to say that what I just read raises the question of what does it mean to say that something like consciousness is an emergent property of physiological or material processes. It's like that to me, that's a phraseology that has become, since the 80s, I've started to see that phraseology, yeah, of an emergent property, and it really kind of begs the question of it's just a fancy way to say that we don't actually understand any linkage.
Well,
but we are imputing that complexity is arising out of simple processes.
Right. That, I mean, it's exactly. I mean, the scientists who the brain researchers and the quote unquote consciousness researchers who coined those terms first. You know, even though the term came up in the 80s, it's been around since, you know, the 19th century with hardcore scientists. And the idea is that if you have a complex enough system, that properties will emerge from that complexity, just like we see in physical systems that aren't present in the constituent components.
And are you saying that Darwin's natural selection might be an example of something like that?
I guess you could say that life systems in general are often thought about like, you know, like the complexity of a plant is and the functioning of the plant is far more complex than we see in the components of carbon and oxygen and nitrogen that go into the molecules that compose the plant. And so, mm-hmm, just like you have this complex living system, so such people say that consciousness could have the same capability. But there's a line of argument that's come up in the, I think, the 80s or 90s. One of the better proponents of this is a philosopher of consciousness named David Chalmers that speaks to or tries to deconstruct that argument. And the basic, I don't remember the details, it's a fairly sophisticated argument, but the basic line of inquiry is that if you are saying that consciousness arises as a result of a certain level of complexity, then you can do a thought experiment where you can replicate the absolute complexity of the brain in terms of, I think he uses some example of like Chinese with pails of water or something like that. You know, some absurd kind of system that's basically replicating all of the functionality of the neurons. And you have this great complicated system that by argument it should have the emergent property of consciousness. So if you start to systematically decomplexify, at what point does consciousness stop being there? And it's when you go through that argument, it actually starts to expose pretty much what you were saying earlier, Rob, which is really no one understands the linkage at all. There's no linkage to the subjective experience of consciousness and the physical complexity of a system. It's just a supposition that's been put there, and even from a logical point of view, it doesn't really hold up well.
Right. So I guess that leads me to think about alternative explanations, and since you've just finished reading the Demystifying Out of Body Experiences book by Luis Minero, our guest last week on this show, perhaps you could talk about what that book asserts for confirmation through personal experience about the relationship between consciousness and physical bodies.
Well, he asserts as a hypothesis for individuals to demonstrate for themselves that we as conscious beings have four different bodies, and we talked about this last week, the physical body an etheric or an energy body, a kind of an emotional body, which he calls the psychosoma, but is also known as the astral body, and then a mental body, which he calls the mental soma, which is less, more formless than the other bodies. And in this model, basically, the consciousness can move separate from the physical body through the etheric and the psychosoma and have these projective experiences. Now, there's two levels of verification that he talks about. One is simply having the experience, having the subjective experience of the of being projected and being lucid in that projectivity. Lots of people report this. It's a pretty well understood phenomenon. Even neuroscientists acknowledge the reality of the phenomena, even though they may not agree with the underlying cause. But what he goes on to say is that you are able to have experiences, if you continue in this kind of practice, where you can project to somewhere on the physical plane and see people doing things or have information about people doing things that you couldn't have had previously. So that starts to form a kernel of what one might call, from a scientific point of view, objective information. If I can have a loose, if I can induce an out-of-body experience at will, and I can have a projective experience, and I go see a friend of mine and see what they're doing or see who they're talking to, etc., etc., come back to my body, call the person up, and they confirm the details that I report, that could be taken as evidence of an out-of-body experience. Another class of objective confirmation is the phenomenon of people making astral dates, that is, you and a associate both agree that you're going to meet somewhere in the extra-physical realm, and you're both practiced at inducing out-of-body experiences, and you make this appointment. You come back into your bodies when you wake up the next day, and you're able to both have a memory or a recollection of this happening. So that would constitute another kind of piece of evidence.
So then, to return to the article that Harris is responding to in Newsweek, it's fair to say that, and remember the quote I gave you earlier, that this Dr. Alexander asserts in the Newsweek article that our current understanding of the mind, quote, now lies broken at our feet, unquote. What you're saying, and I would agree with this, is that he's done no such thing by simply reporting a powerful subjective phenomenon.
Right.
Unless he can produce some kind of evidence as in, that he could have gotten in no other way.
Yeah, exactly. I'd say the critique of Eber Alexander is that he let his enthusiasm get ahead of his scientific formalism, in the sense that his experience, to me, a proper response to his experience might be to dedicate himself to cultivating the practices where he can induce that experience more consistently, and then from a point of view of a kind of a scientific perspective, to begin to establish or cultivate more experience that can form a larger data set so that he could make a more consistent or conclusion. Because it's hard to say from his experience, even though his experience is very similar to, as he reports it, very similar to stories of people who have out-of-body experiences, you know, from a scientific point of view, it's
just anecdotal evidence at best.
Yeah, and you can have there are two reasonable responses to that. One is, who cares? Because, so what? You know, if he had this experience, that's great. You know, he gets this psychological benefit, whatever reality is. And I think where Harris is, you know, why he feels the need to lead the charge is that this guy is crossing a line where he's trying to use his bona fides as a neurosurgeon to somehow have authority to now speak scientifically about a subject matter that he hasn't really done the basic research on. And a personal subjective experience does not necessarily constitute proof in a scientific sense. He may become inspirational. It may change his life and how he experiences things, but it doesn't constitute objective proof.
Yeah, Harris, going back to his response to Alexander's article in Newsweek, he quotes Alexander saying, quote, although I considered myself a faithful Christian, this is before his out-of-body or afterlife experiences, as he apparently puts it. Although I considered myself a faithful Christian, I was so more in name than in actual belief. I didn't begrudge those who wanted to believe that Jesus was more than simply a good man who had suffered at the hands of the world. I sympathized deeply with those who wanted to believe that there was a God somewhere out there who loved us unconditionally. In fact, I envied such people the security that those beliefs no doubt provided. But as a scientist, I simply knew better than to believe them myself. This is a quotation that Harris used, and he responds as you may well appreciate, because what Alexander was doing with that quote is to set up this facile either or situation. Well, either you believe that the tenets of Christianity, that heaven is real, to summarize it in the title of the piece on the cover of Newsweek, or you don't believe that heaven is real. And Harris very skillfully dissects this false choice that is presented to us by Dr. Alexander. And what I appreciate, what you and I think both appreciate about Sam Harris is his ability to not have to completely reject the possibility, to remain agnostic about certain aspects of consciousness, for example, what the quality or nature of consciousness might be, while rejecting the inappropriate conclusions that somebody like Dr. Alexander comes to.
Yeah. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist on KOWSLP 107.3 FM and streaming live at www.kows.fm. Cows Community Radio thanks SolarWorks for their generous support. State rebates and tax credits can reduce the cost of your photovoltaic system. For more information, see them online at solarworksca.com. So, another point that is interesting when you start to talk about scientific verification of these kinds of experiences is that even if you have an experience that where you can confirm details, like if I have a projective experience and I go visit my mother and I see who she's talking to or whatever, and I call her when I wake up, that doesn't necessarily prove anything beyond that there's a remote viewing. It's possible that I could have some sort of telepathic connection that may exist at some level, but that I'm still incorporating that into a dream, or my imagination is constructing a way in which that information is revealed to me. And in the same way, when you're dealing with subjective experiences from an objective scientific point of view, it gets pretty slippery. And that's why I kind of have come to the conclusion that the only real laboratory we have for validation of the separation of consciousness from the physical body is the death of the physical body. We each get to perform that experiment at least once, and in that sense, then one's continued existence would be verification. And beyond that, it's the best way I think one can do is to have a good faith journey where one is trying to be as clear as possible with the nature of one's subjective experience, to not draw conclusions that formulate belief so much as just holding open possibility and continuing to investigate. Does that make sense?
Except for, I wasn't sure what you said about journey. What does a journey have to do with this?
Well, I just mean a journey in the sense of an ongoing commitment to exploring a certain consequence of, or a certain path of subjective experience.
Okay. I certainly have no. That's clear, and I have no problem with it. In a sense, here what we're talking about is a kind of epistemology, which, for those who don't know the fancy word, simply means how do we know what we know.
Yeah, and actually that's what I actually appreciate about Sam Harris, is that more so than many of his colleagues, he is willing to not make a conclusion that he can't sustain. So he can't conclusively say that this guy didn't visit heaven, mm-hmm. but he still feels ferociously that one needs
to uncritically present it as proof that that's
right.
That he did is a dereliction of duty,
right.
Of journalistic duty, if nothing else, an editorial duty.
Yeah, because Harris says in this article that he's had lucid dreams, he's meditated while in lucid dreams.
Which, by the way, parenthetically, that's an interesting claim right there. That's interesting.
Right.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that it's a so he's had the kind of subjective experience that someone would, you know, who relies on a kind of a, what you might call a folk epistemology, if you will, would draw as conclusion of their survivability as a consciousness beyond the physical body. And Harris is not willing to necessarily draw those conclusions, but he continues to investigate the phenomena. And he always did investigate the phenomenon. He advocates the investigation of the phenomena in terms of his readership. He doesn't dismiss these kinds of subjective experiences, but he resists the temptation to draw concrete conclusions based off of the subjective experience.
Yeah, so the distinction here is one that we certainly have talked about before on the show, it seems to me, is the distinction between a healthy and useful skepticism as opposed to a sort of cynical mistrust balanced by an absolutely uncritical acceptance. So the attitude here that makes sense is actually one that the Buddha is well known to have advocated to his followers, which is one where you're not just uncritically accepting what someone else tells you,
right?
And are in fact continuing, as you say, to investigate, continuing to examine, continuing to consider what other explanations might be able to account for the phenomena that otherwise might seem so difficult to account for.
Yeah, and we've talked on this show, and we were just talking with Mark Nepo earlier about faith. We didn't get into doubt so much, but in the Buddhist tradition, faith and doubt are both powerful allies. Faith propels us forward to continue investigating, but doubt reminds us not to get ahead of ourselves in terms of what we take as so.
Yeah, in other words, it's a way to interrogate what is reliable and find a way to take action, whether those are speech acts or other acts in the world that emerge from reliable knowledge and self-knowledge.
Right. Well, and it's interesting that with Luis Monero in his book, beyond just establishing for oneself, a subjective verification of the ability to have the projective experience, he does go on to talk about things that one does in the extraphysical, in particular, he describes assisting, and there are forms of assisting that take place when one's projected, where you're assisting other consciousnesses in dealing with what you might call states of consciousness identification. And then there's ways of assisting where when one is in a physical body.
Does that mean belief?
Yeah, yeah. It's like in a sense that...
In one sense, anyway.
That people whose consciousnesses leave their physical bodies, particularly when their physical body dies, that consciousnesses may not be entirely in a lucid state, and so they're kind of trapped, reliving habit patterns associated with their physical existence. And assistance can take the form of helping people sort of wake up in the condition of their new existence.
Interesting.
And actually what Luis describes there is not novel to the International Academy of Consciousness Studies.
By no means.
You know, that if anyone's read the Seth material, I think that was the first time that material was sort of came into popular Western literature on the subject. But, you know, it's not a new idea. But there's also other forms of help where one can, as an embodied person, in a physical body, essentially make appointments with extra-physical beings such that you provide energy, conscious energy that's somewhat denser. The extra-physical beings are providing kind of the information content and knowing what to do with it, and then that energy is being used to help extra-physical beings who need a certain kind of energy to support them, you know, as they become more lucid again.
Well, but of course you're getting pretty far out there with all this help to extra-physical beings. And how do we verify this?
Yeah, and then, see, that's the interesting point is, like, if one has a consistent set of experiences, if one is able to project, have out-of-body experiences, have these kinds of experiences subjectively, and there's a consistency and an ongoing sort of expansion of knowledge and awareness as a result of these experiences, does it really matter whether one has scientific proof of this? You know, it's kind of that's the other side of this whole debate with Sam Harris is he can be a, you know, ferocious defender of the integrity of the scientific enterprise, but at some point the scientific enterprise may be fairly small in comparison to the possibilities that we have as subjective beings in our existence.
Well, if some of the speakers that we've had on this show are right in the assertion, as you were talking about earlier today, of the irreducibility of consciousness, of consciousness as being an aspect of the greater universe that may even be more widespread than the material phenomena that we are familiar with and assume to be, in general, the all and everything of existence, then the purview of science, as Harris and others would experience it, is indeed limited.
Yeah, and that said, though, I think Harris's sensibility is still an appropriate scientific sensibility that resonates with the whole intent of this show, which is it's not necessary to make truth claims in advance of what one can ultimately verify.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
In some respects, maybe I'm going further to say that we're hard-pressed to really ultimately verify anything. So our scientific sensibility should just simply be trying to use good sense in not becoming fundamentalist or asserting things that with a kind of certainty that closes off further exploration.
In other words, going into belief in the sense different than the quote that I read during the first hour from Mark Nepo's book about belief, but rather the usual sense that the way people use the word belief as something that you hold to be true and hold on to it being true, as opposed to the definition by Brother David Stindl-Rast, which is belief meaning I give my heart to this.
Yeah, and there even the I give my heart to this is a slippery slope, because in some respects some of the problems of belief is the very fact that people have given their hearts and their identities to their beliefs.
Well, I'll disagree with you there, because it's not really that they give their hearts.
Yeah.
They actually give their minds,
yeah,
their heads. And
a Gurdjieffian sense, they've given their lower emotional center.
Right, that may well be. But the point is that the lower emotional center is in large part the creation of the repetitive process of the mind,
right,
whereby or how, which is how people experience belief. Belief is this is true, this is true, this is true. It's a repetition.
Yeah.
It's a repetitive process, and it's engaged in an unconscious way, as opposed to a deliberate process of repetition designed to invoke an opening, as opposed to create a closure.
Right, and even a true scientist recognizes that all they're doing is trying to create models that are more and more effective at explaining things. That the model is ultimately can never be seen as ultimately true. And scientists get into trouble when they assume that they know the truth, because it closes off their openness to other possibilities.
Absolutely, and that's part of the problem with some of the people that Sam Harris is often lumped with, because some of those folks are very willing to make assertions,
right,
that are based on their beliefs about the universe, as opposed to the things that they can prove,
right,
about the universe.
And what I appreciate, just to bring this conversation to a close, what I appreciate about Sam Harris is that he has been courageous in his willingness to take heat from the atheist community, because he isn't willing to go along with the wholesale rejection of the possibilities inherent in subjective phenomena. He's staked out a very consistent position, which is he's not going to draw a conclusion, but he can say this about this based off of scientific experiments that he conducts.
Right, and I think that brings us to the end of our show today.
Indeed, that's all the time we have this week for The Mystical Positivist. Next week, our show features an in-studio conversation with Kevin Turner, M.A., after years of study with yogis, monks, and lamas in India, Nepal, and Southeast Asia, Taiwan, and Japan, Kevin met Michael Harner in 1997 and began his shamanic path. Kevin has worked with shamans in Peru, Nepal, and Mexico. In 2007, in a bit of a turnaround, he was invited to train a group of Mayan elders in psychopomp work. Kevin has worked for Save the Children in Cambodia at Civil War, airlines in Taiwan, IBM in Japan, and has lectured at a dozen universities. He is also a facilitator at the Monroe Institute and a remote viewer. Though born in Arizona, USA, Kevin has lived in Asia for over 20 years and currently has a healing practice in Kyoto, Japan. Tune in for that show next Saturday, that's October 27th. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Integrity of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting Tuesday at 7:30 p.m., October 23rd, at Mini Rivers Books and Tea, that's 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. As part of the Thursdays of Mini Rivers series, on Thursday, October 25th at 7:30 p.m., we'll have poetry reading connections with John Myatek, Carl Frederick, Cynthia Poten, poets in Sonoma County. Three local poets with ears for nature and pens infused with indigenous sensibilities offer to deepen our experience of connection with the earth and each other. Cynthia Poten is a resident of Grayton, is a radio producer and writer. Her poetry explores the inner journey and how history impacts our shared journey. From 2007 to 2011, she produced Poetry Basket, a monthly reading of poems from near and far for KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. John Myatek's poems speak of wild places, of the spiritual relationship between humans and the earth, and of the deeper belief that everything in the natural world is alive and connected, and that you can find this out for yourself if you take the time. His work has appeared in Anesthesia Review, Blaze Vox, River Sedge, Cellar Roots, Big River Poetry Review, Savasvati, Blue Lake Review, and Northwest Review. Carl Frederick wrote rhymes in his teen years, poetry in the last 2 years of college, and virtually nothing for the next 20 years until David White reawakened his muse in 1986. He now lives in Sebastopol and writes for the enjoyment of those who are pleased to see him engaged in pursuits not likely to harm himself and others. So that's three poets, local poets, poetry reading connections at Mini Rivers Books and Tea next Thursday. Cows Community Radio wishes to thank the Inn at Occidental for their support. The Inn at Occidental has luxury accommodations with views of Occidental from its hillside perch. For more information, call them locally at 707-874-1047 or visit their website www.innatoccidental.com. The Salmon Creek Watershed Council meeting is every fourth Tuesday from 6:30 p.m. The next meeting is October 23rd at Salmon Creek School, that's 1935 Bohemian Highway in Occidental. For more information, see them at www.salmoncreekwater.org or call them at area code 707-876-9329. Well, thank you for joining us once again for the Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Please join us again next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hop. Stay tuned. Until then, you will be listening to music from the CD entitled Tracy Stern, Highlights from the Nonsuch Years, 1965 to 1979. This piano solo piece is called Graceful Ghost and was written in 1970 by 20th century composer William Balcom and performed by the composer. Enjoy, and we'll see you next week.